Wake up, everyone. It's time for the Steve Noble Show, where biblical Christianity meets the everyday issues of life in your home, at work, and even in politics. Steve is an ordinary man who believes in an extraordinary God, and on his show, there's plenty of grace and lots of truth, but no sacred cows. Call Steve now at 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Or check him out online at thestevenobleshow.com. And now, here's your host, Steve Noble.
Well, it's a distinct pleasure today, not a usual day on the radio show, but definitely a distinct pleasure today because my guest, well, I'm sitting in his family room down here in Charleston, South Carolina, and my guest happens to be my father, my dad, Fred W. Noble. That W stands for Wentworth, which is now our son's middle name, Clay Wentworth Noble, and my dad is 91 years of age and will be 92 in December. And a member of the Greatest Generation, and here we are hanging out. And a guy with a little bit of radio background, Dad. This is as strange as it sounds. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing fine. Happy to be here.
Glad to have you here and excited to have you here, and I appreciate you being willing to go down another goofy road with your son. What's it like to be 91 years of age?
Incredible.
Why is it incredible?
Well, it's... As I was telling your dear wife earlier today, I never had planned on getting to be this age. I never did think about it, never did worry about it. And now that I'm here, I have to get used to the idea that over 90.
Yeah, it's the deal. This is who you are and where you are.
This is true.
But now before we get into your recollection of your earlier days, World War II, the Greatest Generation, and Pearl Harbor, and then when you decided to join up, and then your involvement in the military, especially after the war ended, and then we kind of got into the occupation in Germany and all of that. But at 91 years of age, this is going to sound a little morose, but how do you feel about the end of your life? I mean, you know, you're not going to live till 120.
No, I certainly know that. I think, Steve, the intriguing part to me is my faith in God is take one day at a time. The whole ball game is up to him. And believing in Jesus as I do, and God's giving us all that we have in this world, it's enough for me. That's for sure.
So you're not fearful of death, and you're ready to meet your Lord.
I am ready in terms of God decides when I go.
Yeah, that's awesome, and always good to hear that. Okay, so let's get in the time machine. We're going to go way back to where were you, and what do you remember about the first time you heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Well, let me back up a little bit. In June 44, we were living in Chicago. We up from San Antonio, Texas in 42, so I was becoming part-time Yankee. And in high school, the start of 42, was there, and in February of 42. So I was in high school. High school was about the same size as San Antonio, Breckenridge High School, which was probably 3,000 students. And I was looking for a big difference in the high schools, our learning curve and all that jazz, but it never really was that much different. The different way of life, and Chicago was, we were in the city on the near north side, as it's called today, and high school was a real gem. I really enjoyed it up there, as I had previously in San Antonio.
So how did you find out about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Well, the attack actually happened on a Sunday morning, and we were at home, of course, before we went to church, and we heard it on the radio. It was a shock. The World War II had already started in 39, which we all knew. Even from that time to Pearl Harbor, I would say everybody I ever encountered was well aware of a World War II. And then when we were attacked Pearl Harbor, it was a super shock. I remember the morning of December 7th, 1941, for some reason, I had been sent by my mother on a bike trip down to the local grocery to pick up some stuff, I don't remember what, and came home, and that's when she'd been on the radio. My dad was a printing pressman, so he was still asleep. And she told me about it, which was shocking, unexpected.
And how old were you?
14.
And how did it make you feel?
Scared. Very scared about the whole thing. But at the same time, I was in ROTC at the high school in Chicago, Lakeview. And that gave us, the very next day, Monday, we were in school. And I was in ROTC at that point. And our sergeant, Henry Lee was his name, wonderful guy, really a sharp soldier. He talked about it, what had happened, and what was going on with the war with us, with Japan. So shortly after, I don't remember when precisely, President Roosevelt declared war on Japan, and then through Congress also did the same thing with Europe.
Now, did you assume at the time, because you were in ROTC in high school, was it assumed right away that you and your buddies would be joining up at the right age and that you would be going off the war? Or were you kind of, well, we don't know where this is going to go?
Well, we sort of thought we might get called up. We didn't really know the draft. I think the draft started as far back as 39, but I'm not sure of that. Anyhow, I knew the draft was coming. We all did. A lot of us leading into after Pearl Harbor, ROTC was even more important there in Chicago or everywhere else for that matter. So that was very important, and we learned an awful lot about service at that point in time for the next year and a half till I graduated in June of 44. Now, and I was 17 and a half, June of 44. So I enlisted because they had a program called ASTRP, or Army Specialized Training Reserve Program. And if I enlisted in that at the age 17 and a half, we all knew, several of us did from school, we all knew that we'd be drafted when we graduated. Every time we turned 18, and I was due 18 that following December.
Well, let me jump in there right quick.
Sure.
When you were 14 and heard about Pearl Harbor, the initial reaction is fear and being scared. By the time you're 17 and 18, or especially 17, finishing high school, were you to the point then, Dad, where it was resolve and I want to get in?
Well, I didn't. I really had the feeling I didn't want to be drafted. I wanted to be in the Army as soon as I turned 18, That was the only way I could do it.
Yeah, got it. Hold that thought. We're talking to my dad, a member of the Greatest Generation, Fred Noble, age 91 years young. This is Steve Noble live from their home in Charleston, South Carolina. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show, coming to you live today from Charleston, South Carolina, at my parents' house. My parents are alive and well and pretty amazing. My dad is 91 years of age. My mother is 86. And they're hanging out down here in Charleston. Gina and I, my wife, came down to visit them for a couple of days. And I've wanted to do this show with my father at 91 years of age. He is a member of what Tom Brokaw renamed the Greatest Generation, and aptly so. And we don't often have the opportunity to talk to somebody, any of us really, and I don't often do it myself, and he's my dad, to talk about life back during World War II and what that was like back then, and to find out about the war. My dad was 14 when Pearl Harbor took place, and he shared earlier initial reaction to that was just being scared, but going through high school and being in the ROTC. Then I guess, Dad, you would say you came to a point where you had a sense of purpose. Would that be an accurate statement?
Yeah, I'd buy that. Yeah.
And sure. Then you wanted to get in. You could have been drafted, but you actually wanted to enlist go in.
I just felt I should enlist. I found out about ASTRP, Army Specialized Training Reserve Program, which if I enlisted in spring of 44, I would go to college when I graduated in June of 44 for 6 months. At the pleasure of the United States Army, and then after that go into basic training with the Army, and the ASTRP was graded with 6 months up at St. Norbert College west of here, Wisconsin.
So that whole time, though, you're anticipating, the war is raging in Europe, it's still raging in the Pacific, you are anticipating at that time you're going to be in battle, you're going to see action.
Yes.
And how did you How did you deal with that? What did that? What was that like to think about that? You already knew the hundreds of thousands of U.S. soldiers had already died by that point. But how did that affect you?
It's hard to remember, but at the time, as I recall, it was the only right thing to do because the draft was inevitable. The war was on very heavy in 44 when I got out of high school. And I knew that I wanted to be in the Army. I don't know really why, but I did. And at the same time, with ROTC training that I got both in Texas and Illinois, I really wanted to be an officer. So the whole sight thing in terms of what I was trying to do was finish ASTRP, which was 6 months of basic engineering college, and then go into basic training. And then I even was thinking about West Point back then, but I wore glasses in, so West Point in those days.
And you wear glasses today, still yes, today. So you said something a minute ago, Dad, and we're talking to my father, who's 91, Fred W. Noble, and we're in his home here in Charleston. By the way, if you want to join us and see how good he's doing and how good he looks at 91, you can join us on Facebook Live. Just go to Facebook, and in the search box, just put Steve Noble Show in there, and you'll find us sitting here literally in my parents' family room. That's N-O-B-L-E. So Steve Noble Show, just put it in the search box on Facebook, and you can join us right here in the room. But a minute ago, Dad, you said it was the right thing to do. Like, it was the only right thing to do to join. Why did you say that?
Well, there was no thought that I ever encountered of anybody not wanting to do their part in terms of serving in the service during the war.
So you didn't know anybody that didn't want to be a part of it?
No.
That's hard to believe.
Could be.
Given the divided nature of our country today.
Yes.
But back, I mean, did you realize how precious that was at the time, or was that just this big patriotic fervor? What was that like?
It was a normal reaction in unison. Nobody was talking about unison. It just really was. We were up against it with the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and we all knew it. I never knew of anyone who didn't want to do their part, so to speak, and thus we did.
Susan on Facebook Live asked a great question. How did your parents feel about you going off to serve and joining and being in the ROTC and knowing that your trajectory would take you into World War II?
They were contemplative, shall I say. They knew that I really wanted to go. They knew that the United States was in a terrible situation, and we needed to do it and beat the enemy, so that's what it was all about. They agreed.
And so as you were approaching the end of your training, when the war was officially over, Victory in Europe Day, and then when mm-hmm. Japan signed
right.
Their surrender aboard the battleship, I mean, what was that? Do you remember when that happened, and what was that like for you, since you were fully ready and able and trained at that point to go to war?
Well, in January of 45, I went out of the ASTRP into the regular Army full time. I went to basic training, infantry training at Camp Robinson, Arkansas. That was four months. Applied for officer candidate school, was accepted. They were very busy at the time.
I bet.
In June of 45. So I went over to in July of 45, I went to OCS, Officer Candidate School, Fort Benning, Georgia, near Columbus, Georgia. Graduated as second lieutenant in the United States Army. Second youngest lieutenant, as a matter of fact, in October of 1945.
How old were you?
I was 18.
Oh, golly.
Well, I was going to be 19 in December.
Just a whippersnapper.
Yeah, in October before. Anyhow, I was sent to Camp Roberts.
That's wild. You were 18, a second lieutenant, ready to go.
Yes.
And your grandson, who has your middle name,
yes.
Clay Wentworth Noble, our son, Gina, yes. and my son, who's 17, he'll be 18 in February. He was a year behind you, yet there you were, a year ahead of him, and a second lieutenant.
True.
But that was just normal back then.
Yes. Well, everybody I ever knew was in service. And anyhow, the...
Right, when your parents are 91 and 86, everything's loud in their house. So you're hearing the phone in the background and Alexa and whatever else is connected in here.
Lower
so
left.
Just ignore it for now. We won't pay any attention to that. But we were talking about that, and so you're getting ready to go in. The war has ended. So that was my original question. How did you feel about the fact that the war was over?
VE Day and then VJ Day, both occurred before. That was happening right when one of them was happening right when I got out of OCS in October 45. So we knew that. Thank God, we had won the thing, meaning the Allies. So sent me out to troop training at Camp Roberts, which I mentioned. That was for 6 weeks. Then they sent me to Europe.
Was there a sense of disappointment? I don't want to sound macabre, but did you feel like you had missed your shot?
Not really. I knew. I found that out when I got over to Europe. I saluted the platoon leader when I went in. I mean, the platoon sergeant and the company commander when I got over there. And
to Europe?
Signed, yeah. Because they had been through six battle stars, 3rd Infantry Division, 30th Infantry Division,
wow,
of the 3rd Division. I'll get it straight in a minute. And they were all combat veterans. I was the only one non-combat. And I just felt great respect for them and real love, I learned, for what they had accomplished. My company commander, Abel Bike from Chicago, he was field promoted to first lieutenant. He was captain by the time I knew him. He had been in all six battles from North Africa forward, so I was feeling pretty insufficient about all of that.
I'm sure that we're going to pick it up there. So this is the after World War II. My dad in the military goes to Europe and is part of the occupation in Germany, and also had an opportunity to work with a group of black soldiers. And I remember this was 1945 and 1946, pre-civil rights. Amazing story there. Right now, we're going to chalk this up to a clash of civilizations. This is Steve Noble on the Steve Noble Show. Yes, that's Rush, the band Rush, the intro music to a segment that I'm talking to my father, Fred W. Noble. The W stands for Wentworth, which I think is a cool enough name. My wife and I love that middle name, which is why we gave that middle name to our third child, Clay Wentworth Noble. And talking to my dad, he's 91, my mother's 86. We're down here visiting them in Charleston, South Carolina. He's a member of the Greatest Generation. We don't have a lot of them left, and so I just felt it was a pleasure, a blessing, a privilege, an honor, and quite frankly, an obligation to do the show today with my dad and talk about his recollections from being involved with World War II and a wee little lad back then. He was 14 when Pearl Harbor happened, and was in ROTC in high school, and then went through advanced training and went in as a second lieutenant, 18-year-old second lieutenant. The war ended in the meantime, but my dad went off to Europe to serve during the occupation. So we'll kind of pick it up there. So, Dad, when you're over there, and then Janet on Facebook asked if you ever traveled back to Europe after the war. We'll get to that. Sharon, who happens to be my sister and your daughter, asked a question about some of the tough things that you experienced while you were over there. But when you went over there, what was your job? You're going over to Europe, and was it specifically to go to Germany?
Well, I was a second lieutenant in the infantry. They assigned me to the 3rd Infantry Division, 30th Regiment, out in Witzenhausen, Germany, which we were... My platoon was searching something like 11 or 14 trains a day going in and out of the Russian zone. And at that point in time, it happened quickly right after the war, the zone situation with Russia being where it was, where it still is, well, East Germany now,
right,
which is part of full Germany now. But we had an awful lot of contraband being taken back and forth on the train. So,
what's contraband?
Illicit, everything from, it wasn't drugs so much then, was just illicit contraband, meaning arms. Some of that was happening, stolen goods, rifles, ammunition, all that type of stuff was still being moved back and forth across Europe. And so things were pretty tough. It was a great education for me right quick. And I stayed there about, I don't know, 3 or 4 months, and then went from there down to Dachau, where the second-level war crimes were being conducted, plus Dachau itself was a World War II POW camp that Germans had for Americans and Jews and everybody abducted from around Europe
What did you know about Dachau? Were you full? Would you say you were fully informed by the time you got to Germany about Dachau and Auschwitz and all the rest of the death camps?
I knew about some. I knew about the death camps and that stuff, but I didn't know anything particular about them. When I got there, the Dachau was, as I said, were doing the second level war crimes. But we had museums and stuff, and we had a couple of German prisoners still there that I met and kept up with.
What did you experience? Because you knew what had happened there. You were there a year after it happened.
Yes.
So this is all pretty fresh.
Yeah. Yeah.
All the bodies can't be gone by that point. But
German citizens, when we encountered with them and running around Dachau in jeeps and stuff, they didn't really want to admit that they were in the end of the Nazi ball game, and they didn't even want to admit that Dachau existed. It's about 6 miles out of town. And
they just would not accept the reality that it happened.
That's true. They sort of wanted to look the other way. And after that, I went into the 1st Infantry Division. And interesting, down in Bavaria, they had me with six or seven enlisted guys.
Well, what'd you think of that reaction of Germans not being willing to embrace the reality of what their country had done?
I'd say we were saddened by it. But then we'd never been in that shape ourselves, so
sure,
we didn't know what the hell to experience. So after that, I got into the situation of checking out the chemical plants that Germans had built in the Black Forest, they were hiding all the pipes and stuff between the various buildings in the woods so that American aircraft Allied aircraft wouldn't see them and bomb their factories.
What were the chemical plants for?
They were making powder.
They were making powder.
More powder, yeah. Gunpowder,
yeah,
I should
yeah.
say.
Did you see or experience anything that was the remnants of, the leftovers of the Nazi death camps?
In Dachau, yeah.
Do you mind if I ask what you saw?
Oh, well, the thing that sticks strongest in my memory was lampshades of tattooed skin from people they put to death, which they thought was funny and great to do. They'd take the skin from their chest and their back and put it on these lampshades.
Jeez.
So when you turn the lamp on, you'd see it. That was very tough.
Yeah.
And the other things that we had all Polish guards at that point, and most of them were veterans of World War II. And they had a vengeance in mind that you wouldn't believe in terms of handling German prisoners and stuff.
Yeah.
We're down there on trial.
Well, how did you guys feel about it? I mean, the Germans, this is a year after these guys would have been killing you.
Yeah.
Now they're prisoners and you're encountering Germans every day. How did you guys process that? How did you feel about Germans?
We just didn't much care about them. They were behind the whole thing, actually, as it turned out, which we learned, and just no respect for them. I have it now, of course,
yeah,
but not then.
And then what about, you mentioned this the last time we talked about this, I didn't even think I knew about this, about your involvement with, was it a black regiment, African-American
yes.
regiment? So
yeah,
we're talking 1946, 47.
Yes.
This is definitely before the Civil Rights Movement
yes.
and
yes.
segregation. And,
yes.
what, and what was that like? Paint that picture for us.
Well, I'm a half Texan, half Illinois type person, so I call myself a hybrid Yankee. And being in San Antonio as long as we were before Chicago, I really didn't have any feelings one way or the other, nor pro for that matter. And when they established this black regiment in Grafenwöhr, Germany, which was an old camp for German training to train these. All the black people in the service were brought together because of integration and all that type of thing. We didn't know too much about it other than we knew we were being sent to a black group, and that was okay. We had about 20% black officers and 80% white officers. It did the world best for me, as I can say it, about understanding integration, segregation, and the inhumanity way that blacks had been treated all the years long before I was born. So that was about 7 months of infantry training.
So what was that like to work with them? I mean, from their perspective, do you think? Were they leery of you as a white officer, or what? How did that go?
I think it was careful at first, and then once they found out that I wasn't a zealot on the negative side, they accepted me as, platoon leader and then executive officer of a company later on. The whole thing was very beneficial for me personally, because I really found out, as I became friends with a couple of sergeants and people like that, we would really talk about their life, wherever they were from, north or south in the United States, et cetera. It was just darn near overwhelmed me in terms of things they talked about, leveled about. We're not exaggerating at all, I don't think.
Sharing their experiences.
Yes. And that was tough.
Yeah, I'm sure. We're talking to my father, Fred Noble. We're down in Charleston, South Carolina, actually doing the show today from his living room here in beautiful Charleston, South Carolina, down here with my wife, Gina, for a visit for a couple of days. My dad is one of the a member of the shrinking, almost gone Greatest Generation, those that were around and served during World War II, and just blessed to have this opportunity to kind of pick his brain and go back in time with him. For all of us, because most of us don't ever get to talk to people like my dad and people that age, and a lot of them aren't around anymore. So this is really a great opportunity. But if you want to join us on Facebook, just go to Facebook, your Facebook page. You're probably there already. Just put Steve Noble Show in the search box, and you'll jump right in here on the Facebook live broadcast. But tell us, Dad, about coming back. What was America like when you got back? And we're going to hit a commercial break here pretty soon.
Let me preface that with the service with the Black Infantry Regiment. Was the most important thing of my life, among other, not the most, but one of the more important things of my life, in terms of I really began to understand what the heck was going on back in the States. And then when I came home, I was promoted to first lieutenant, and stayed in the reserve for several years. And, of course, lived all our life, rest of the time here in the United States. Now, specifically, what did you ask?
Yeah, what was it like coming home, back to the States?
Well, by the time I came home, which was 47, I guess. Yeah, my uniform was noticed right away, because everybody was not in uniform, so I didn't wear the uniform. But about
did chicks dig it? That's what I really want to know. Did the ladies dig it? There you are. You're back from Europe. You're in uniform. Did the ladies, females, women, did they like the fact that you were in uniform?
You mean when I came back? Or
yeah. Hold that thought. We'll get to it when we come back. This is Steve Noble. We'll be right back. So what are we waiting for? Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show, live today from Charleston, South Carolina, actually in the family room of my parents' house. Now, I'm 52. My parents are still alive, obviously. My dad is 91. My mother's 86. My dad, a member of the Greatest Generation, and was 14 when Pearl Harbor happened, and then all through high school, ROTC, and expecting fully to sign up and go in and be a part of the war. And the war ended while he was in some advanced training, but he did serve in Germany during the occupation, and then came back to America after that. Was that 1947, Dad, when you came back?
I think that's right.
Yeah, about 1947, and we were talking about the unity that existed in this country, which have you seen that kind of unity since? Have you seen anything unify the country?
Not to that extent, though.
Because we saw a little bit with 9/11.
Yes.
Of course, but that lasted for maybe 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
And then once we went into Afghanistan, especially with Iraq, then everything kind of disintegrated, that unity. But that was the closest, I think, my generation ever saw that kind of unity in the country.
That's true.
Where there was a united cause around the fact that we had been attacked.
Yes.
9/11 was my Pearl Harbor.
Pearl Harbor galvanized the American public without question.
Yeah.
And there wasn't any doubting about it.
Barry Bright, who's my buddy with Wilkins Radio, and we recently expanded into several Wilkins markets. We're on in Indianapolis now, and Albuquerque, New Mexico, Kansas City, Missouri, and as well as Asheville, North Carolina. So, Barry, thanks for tuning in, and thanks for helping out with that. But Barry had a question, Dad. What impact did your faith have on your military service and vice versa? And would you say that you were a believer, a follower of Jesus, when you were in the Army? So your faith versus the experience you had back then.
Well, I was raised a Presbyterian,
I'm not going to hold that against you.
So I believed in Jesus and God, et cetera, went all through high school, elementary school in San Antonio, et cetera. I never had any doubts about it, just never thought about it very much.
It was kind of more of a private thing back in those days, wasn't
it? Yeah, but in Europe, I visited an awful lot when I had time. I visited an awful lot of churches because I was interested in seeing the decor, the architecture, the whole nine yards. Plus, I had a couple of priests and religious guys, pastors, that I knew in the various aspects of the Army itself.
Were there chaplains? You remember the chaplains back in the day?
Chaplains were wonderful people, no matter what faith they came from, Jewish, Christian, whatever. I've always been a good Christian, in my view. And there wasn't anything new in Revelation or anything about over there, other than that was all the history of so much of the Reformation and all that other
sure.
type thing that occurred.
Yeah, and interesting perspective there, but going back
and
to
tell
Europe.
Your friend with the radio, I salute him for bringing in you on your show.
Yeah, well, you just did, because he's with us on Facebook Live, so you're talking to Barry directly. I don't have to relay that message. You just did. So compare and contrast, and we're not going to get into politics and stuff here. I just meant America in general. You saw America pretty much at her greatest, I think.
I would agree.
During World War II, so that's the 1940s, to where we're at today and the divisiveness, the moral decline, which you've talked about often over the years. So what's your view of America today versus America in the middle of and right after World War II?
I think you have to start with the impact of electronics and cyberspace, et cetera, on the entire world population, if you will, to whatever extent the penetration is occurring around the world. Here in the States, I think it's given rise to an awful lot of incredible variety of feelings and beliefs about everything from religion forward to politics. I think as a dogma, which is still real, the basic premises of American freedom, etc., is as strong as it ever has been. It's just not thought of it as it was then because it wasn't threatened in that respect.
That's a great point.
As it is today.
Familiarity breeds contempt, you might say.
Well, I used to say that in my day.
Well, you don't know how good you have it until it's taken away, right?
That is true. That is true. By and large, I think, I have to digress a little bit, Steve.
That's fine.
As you well know, I mentored for 5 years, and I'm going to pitch everybody in your audience as you get older, and you don't have to get older, to look into mentoring in terms of grade school, elementary school, that is, junior high and high school.
Because you were doing that in your 80s.
Yeah, I did that in my 80s. I was 5 years of the most heartwarming years of my life, actually. In that respect,
yeah,
because the mentoring can mean so much to the young, a few youngsters in each school who have some troubles.
And what about the moral decline of the nation?
It's still a very independent thing. It always has been. It's up to each individual to answer that as they see fit. I think the morals brought forward by parents could be stronger. But then I'm not sure they're not stronger. I don't really know. It's just from my perspective today, it's looked at with a little distance. It's too free. But then on the other hand, freedom is precious. So why knock it?
Well, that's what comes with freedom, freedom of choice, free
yes.
will, enables evil. And that's just the deal. And as soon as you give fallen human beings the free will to choose, you get evil. That's why evil exists. By the way, consequently, love can't exist unless it's a choice, right?
That's true. That's
so
true.
If love's going to be a choice and God is love, then he has to have free will.
Yes.
And as soon as you enable free will, evil comes into the picture. And so there's your little answer to the problem of evil, if you want to know it. But are you hopeful about America? I mean, you're 91. You're in, you know, you're in your golden years, and you're out of here one of these days soon, and to be reunited with the Lord in heaven. And but are you worried about our country, Dad? Are you hopeful
no,
about it?
I'm very strong about the Americans all Americans, all colors. It doesn't make any difference. I think the basics of all of us are so strong that no matter what comes our way, we're going to survive and handle it properly.
What's your advice to everybody significantly younger than you? What's your advice to the rest of us? And then I want you to speak to people your own age that might be listening or might hear this later. But what's your advice to us younger generation?
Well, get everybody an equal chance. Mm. I just think that I'm a little dumbfounded with the question, Steve. I just see great strength in the United States of America, and all, and you know, in Europe and the rest of the world. I think they're coming. I have great respect for Mandela as an example for what he accomplished down there in South Africa.
Yeah,
I just think all of that will prevail. Continue. It does prevail. Will continue to prevail. I was on the Russian border for several months back then in 45, and knew some war prisoners of war and stuff like that, and they had really been through tough times, very tough, more than we could imagine.
Sure.
But I still think the strength, just go back to the United States itself, the strength of all Americans is strong enough to handle anything that comes along.
I wanted to bring this up because this has had a huge impact on my life and my life on radio specifically. But just for you, the rest of you guys, my father raised us with this notion of what he calls restless curiosity. And every time you talk to people that have known my dad for years and at his 90th birthday party a year and a half ago, the one thing that people kept saying repeatedly was that when you're spending time with Fred Noble, he's asking you all kinds of questions, and you know that it's authentic, that he really cares about you. He really is interested in you, and he's not asking the question from some kind of a sales mentality. He's not doing it just to pass the time or because it's good social graces. He actually is interested in you as an individual. How did you end up that way? There aren't a lot of people that are like that, but just about everybody that I know that knows you all say the same thing about you. You're authentically, deeply interested in everybody you meet.
I never really thought about it till you brought it up, and then those other three children ahead of you, they sort of brought it up, maybe not as fully as you.
But that's my style, you know that.
Yeah, I know that. I really never thought about it in any way other than just, you know, plain old curiosity about another human being.
Yeah, well, everybody knows that about you. So, all right, so a word of advice to people, and I think you're probably going to go back to mentoring. But if you could say something to every older, retired age person, 70 and up in America today, what would your challenge to them be?
Well, not only be alert like most of you are, but Janine and I were in a retirement community for a little over a year. That was a wonderful life. It just wasn't for us. But I think the thing that worries me the most as we age is we don't stay as curious as we were 30 years ago about what's going on in the world, especially here in the United States. And regardless of your persuasion, it doesn't matter about that. Is that curiosity and wanting to be more informed than you were yesterday. So for today, you should stay informed. It's not all entertainment. It's not, you know, there's a lot of serious things that need to be addressed.
Sure.
And should stay up to speed and up to date about as much as possible.
Be a lifetime learner.
Without question.
Yeah, well, that's obviously rubbed off on, I think, all four of your kids, and it seems like just about every one of your grandchildren. It certainly rubbed off on me, which is why doing radio is actually kind of easy for me, because I grew up in a very opinionated, outspoken home, and I was raised to be curious, and I am naturally curious. That's just a gift, not only from God, but from my parents and from my dad especially, who taught me that. Dad, what a huge honor that you did this with me today, and I know that you've blessed the audience. I love you. I'm proud of you. You've had an eternal impact on my life, and thanks for being my guest today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Those are beautiful words, which I will honor for the rest of my life.
Amen. Sure. I love you, Dad.
I love you.
Thank you. Okay, friends, we'll be back on tomorrow, Theology Thursday, talking to Dr. Tate Cockrell. We're going to be talking about good marriages and bad marriages and how to keep one and deal with the other. This is Steve Noble on The Steve Noble Show. God willing, we'll talk again soon.